the presentation technology here straightened out. But let me go ahead and start with introductions. It clicks? Okay, cool. My name is Kim Horoy-Rogalski, and I manage the off-road implementation section at the California Air Resources Board. Thank you for joining us today here in Diamond Bar. Let me introduce, we have some other Air Resources Board staff that are here, and I want to point them out, so in case you want to snag us afterwards with any questions or comments, feel free to do that. We have Bob Cross, who's the Division Chief of the Mobile Source Control Division at ARB. Elizabeth Ura here, who's one of the off-road implementation staff. Beth White is in purple and just leaving the room, waving in the back. We also have Corey Palmer from my staff, who is around somewhere, and Din Kwok from our Moyer retrofit program, incentive program is here. So if folks have detailed questions about incentives, she's a good one to talk to as well. All right, so with that, I think maybe we can go forward. Okay. Oh, okay. We also are webcasting today, so hello to those of you that are watching on the webcast. If you do have a question or comment and you're watching on the webcast, please send an email to the following address. It's eura@arb.ca.gov. That's eura@arb.ca.gov, and Elizabeth will relay your question or comment to us. So I still don't really know how to work this. How do I make it go back and forth? Sorry. Now, how do we go back? There is no going back. There okay. Okay. We're going to go forward only. Okay. Can you go back to the beginning? Okay, anyway. We did a first workshop. We're here today to talk about implementing some legislatively directed changes to the off-road regulation. Thank you. And as part of the budget agreement in February, the legislature asked us to make some changes to the off-road regulation, and we had a first workshop on April 7th in Sacramento to talk about this, and today is a second workshop to talk about the same thing. We did get a lot of feedback at the April 7th workshop and in the days following that, and we've taken that into account. And so we do have some changes today to what we proposed on the 7th. We put those changes in writing into a little discussion paper that we sent out about a week ago, and that's also available here as one of the handouts. We also, as many of you who are dealing with the regulation probably already know, the reg can get pretty complicated, and these new provisions unfortunately make it even more complicated. So we did have some questions about how exactly all the accounting is going to work with these new credits. And so we wrote up some examples to make it absolutely clear. And we did send those out to our listserv, and they're here as an additional handout as well. Another thing I wanted to mention was we have been doing half-day training sessions, introducing the regulation to affected fleets, explaining how to do the reporting, explaining how it all works. This is not one of those introductory presentations. So if there's anyone here who really doesn't know much about the regulation and just came to get a first introduction to it, what I would recommend is I'll hook you up right now with one of my staff people who can teach you about it, because the presentation today is really assumes an understanding of the base regulation and is talking in very specific detail about some of the provisions. So if you haven't really thought a lot about the regulation before, the rest of it's not going to make much sense. So is there anyone in that situation who came here just hoping for a first introduction? Aha, okay. Corey, can you raise your hand? Corey Palmer is the gentleman in the back in the blue shirt. If you are in a situation of needing an introduction, you can turn around and you'll find Corey, and he can give you private lessons right now. Okay. Okay, so with that, let's get started. Okay, so here's what I was hoping to go over today. First, the changes that were required by as part of the budget deal, and it's called Assembly Bill 8. And there's details in the legislation telling us how we need to change the regulation, but there's still some sort of judgment calls and little details we need to work out as we implement this. So I'll tell you what our goals were for Yes?
I'm so sorry. Apparently, they did the copy, and I swear I have to check everything. He skipped every other page, so every other page is missing from the handout. So I'm going to go try and copy these as fast as I can. And I think I'll do an every other page starting here so that I can get the complimentary packet out to everybody. I don't know.
Why don't you just do replacements?
Okay.
Okay, as you may notice as we go forward, your handouts are screwed up. So so if you can, that's going to make us some new handouts that actually include all the slides instead of just half the slides. But for now, you can focus on what I'm saying and what's up on the screen and have comfort that we'll get you the full package in the right order soon. Okay, so we're going to talk about what the legislature told us to do and how we made decisions about how to implement it. We'll walk through the three changes that the legislature asked us to make, and then I'll explain how we propose to implement that. And there's four things that we've decided to, that we are proposing to change, different than what we said we were thinking of doing on April 7th. And they are as follows. One, a lot of fleets told us that they've been retiring not only Tier Zeros but also higher tier vehicles, and so we want to propose to give credit for those retirements of Tier Ones that reduced fleet horsepower. We also had a lot of comments about the time period that we chose for looking at reduced activity, and so we're proposing an earlier baseline time period for looking at reduced activity. We also heard from fleets that not many fleets have absolutely perfect hour meter records. Maybe no fleets have absolutely perfect hour meter records. So we're looking for ways to allow fleets to document their activity reduction without having perfect records. And then we also had sort of a lot of blank stares at the April 7th workshop. When we tried to explain how all the accounting would work with the previous sort of complicated credit provisions and these new credit provisions added in. So we've done our best to simplify it and as well as lay out exactly what we're proposing in the example document. And there's a couple examples in here and then more involved examples in that example document that I'll walk you through. And then we did some thinking about, okay, so what's it going to mean for the regulation in terms of the emission benefits that the regulation achieves and the cost it imposes when we make these legislatively directed changes. So I'll talk about that and how it plays into the state implementation plan. And I'll talk about some potential changes that we want to get your feedback on, things that we could adjust in the regulation at the same time as we make these legislatively directed changes to maybe mitigate some of the negative side of doing these changes. There's also a couple sort of cleanup items, things in the regulation that need to be corrected or clarified. And while we have the regulation open, we're proposing to fix those as well. And so I'll describe those to you. And I'll wrap up finally with a discussion of the next steps. We are planning on proposing these changes to our board in July, so our board would vote up or down at that time in late July. I definitely want to emphasize that this is a workshop. The whole point of having this is for us to get your feedback. So there's a number of places throughout the presentation where I have green text that says, like, input wanted, feedback wanted. So those are places where we especially want to make sure to get your opinion. But if there's other questions or comments you have as we go, we definitely welcome those. Okay. So as I sort of alluded to at first, Assembly Bill 8-2X is basically the budget, and it was approved by the governor on February 20th, 2009, and it's directing us specifically to make changes to the off-road regulation. And really the intent of it was to recognize that there's a recession right now and that the fleets that are affected by this regulation are hurting, and to try to give them some relief from complying with the regulation if they have been impacted by the recession. The changes aren't self-implementing, which is why we're doing this process and having to take proposed amendments to our board. There's been some misreporting about what these changes are. They're not a wholesale delay of the regulation, so like the idling provisions, the disclosure requirements, the requirements for fleets to report their data to us are all still in effect. For fleets that haven't experienced reduced activity or haven't, shrunk their fleet size, the regulation is still in place. So it's not just a complete delay of the regulation. It's specific credit for fleets that may allow many fleets to postpone taking action. Okay. So as we read through the law that the legislature gave us, and we thought about how exactly to implement this and how to work out all the details, here's what we were trying to do. One is to follow the directions, do what the legislature told us to do. The second is to try to keep it as simple as possible, because the regulations are already pretty hard to get your mind around. And we wanted to keep it as simple as possible and sort of align with the existing structure of the regulation wherever we could. And then we wanted to make sure that if any fleets had existing credits that they've been counting on, like, for example, if you've done some repowering or you've done some early retrofitting and you've mapped out your compliance plan, we didn't want anybody to lose existing credits that they had, because that would really be completely unfair. And so we wanted to make sure nobody ended up with less credits than they had before. I think now I may be able to go backward and forward. Or maybe not. No? Okay. Okay, can I have the mouse back, please? Okay. I had one workshop I did recently where there was a power outage all through downtown Sacramento, and I had to give the rest of the workshop in the dark. So this is much better. Thank you. Okay. 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 So there were three. So let's go over what the legislature asked us to do. And everyone here should have a handout that has the exact legislative language, so you can read it in its gory detail. Does everybody have that? It's one page? Yes, okay. Okay, so there were three main changes. One is the legislature asked us to allow fleets to do less than they otherwise would have in 2011, less in 2012, and then make up for the difference in 2013. Instead of sort of making steady progress over time, they asked us to allow fleets to do 20% of that total three-year commitment, another 20%, and then do the remaining 60% in 2013, sort of like a balloon payment on a house. So that's what we're calling this 2020-60 backed. He took my mouse. Yay. Okay. Okay, so that's the first change we'll talk about. The second one is, recognizing that many fleets are struggling economically now and may be shrinking, getting rid of equipment to try to stay in business. The legislature asked us to give additional credit for fleets that have retired vehicles and thereby reduce their total horsepower. And then third, the legislature recognized that there were many fleets that used to operate their equipment a lot more than they currently are, because there's just not a lot of work right now. And so they asked us to give credit for that reduction in activity. Okay. So those are the three. Let me walk through one by one how we propose to implement them. No. Oh, Jesus. Can I please have the mouse back? Okay, so those of you that are already familiar with the regulation know the way it's set up is fleets have to meet fleet average targets, or if they can't meet the fleet average targets, then they need to satisfy what we call the BACT requirements. And for PM, what that means is you have to retrofit a certain percent each year. And for NOx, what that means is you have to turn over a certain percent each year. So with this change is doing is changing those percents. So the percents are less in 2011 and 12 and more in 2013. Gentlemen, do we have a way to advance the slide here? Good. Slide, please. Uh-huh. Okay, so what you'll see in the top row of this table here are the percents that maybe you're familiar with if you've been planning out your compliance with the regulation, 8% turnover and 20% retrofitting. So what this change is doing is it's changing that 8% in 2011 to 4.8 and changing that 20% to 12. So it's less in back. It's less in 2011 and 2012, and then you'll see the percents jump up in 2013. So if you do a little less in 2011, less in 2012, you have to do more in 2013. Next slide, please. What the next slide shows is where we got those numbers. Like if you're wondering, why 4.8? Why 12? Where'd you get 14.4? This is the third one. Oh, yeah, it works. I'm not going to walk you through the math. This is where we got the numbers. If you have any questions, you want me to go over this further, ask me. Okay. But then we realized there's one special case that we wanted to take care of, and that's let's say there's a large fleet that's meeting the fleet averages at the beginning, and then suddenly something happens and they can't meet them anymore in 2013. We didn't want that fleet to suddenly be subject to more than they otherwise would have been. It's kind of the same idea. What the legislature was intending to do here was to make it easier for fleets, not harder. So if there's a large fleet that meets the targets in 2012, then in 2013 they can't meet the targets, then they still get to use the old backed requirements. They won't be required to turn over more than 8% or retrofit more than 20%. And that also holds for medium fleets that are first subject to fleet average requirements in 2013. Okay. So let me pause there. That's the first one. Does anyone have any questions about that one or comments? Did you understand kind of what I was trying to explain? Yeah? You know what? Gordon, come on up because people can't hear you unless you speak into the microphone, please. Yeah, and while he's heading up, if there's folks who are watching the webcast and you have a comment or question, please send an email to eura, that's EYURA at arb.ca.gov.
My name is Gordon Downs, Downs Equipment Rentals. Question is for the information of our group that's here, how many people in this group are now meeting fleet average or expect to meet it in 2010 and 2011? I would just like to know if people are meeting it. Raise your hand. One, two, three, four. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I forgot a part of my question, and the question would be, how many of you have a large fleet that are meeting fleet target averages? So there's still 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay, just wanted to know how people were managing to do that.
Did you have a question about the topics we're here to discuss today?
Well, later on, as we go into this further, but it seemed to me this is good information for you to have to see how many people are able to meet this fleet target average.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's reporting this year, so every fleet's reporting to us, and so we'll have all that information for the next couple months.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Oh, there's me. And there's nothing. Okay. Oh, my God. All right, so that's the first one. Let me talk about the second change. Okay, and again, this was intended to give some relief to fleets that have been shrinking due to the poor economy. And the exact language of what the legislature asked us to do is in your handout, but it's basically reflecting vehicle retirements that took place between March 1st of 2006 and March 1st of next year. And it's giving credit only for those retirements that shrunk a fleet. So if a fleet's turning over and they're buying new vehicles at the same time, this wouldn't help them. When we first made a proposal for this on April 7th, we proposed only allowing credit for retirement of Tier Zeros. And then we heard back on April 7th and after that And there were many fleets that, you know, had turned over tier zeros, but it also turned over higher tier vehicles and would like to get credit for those as well. So our revised proposal today is to be consistent with the order of turnover requirements in the regulation, such that fleets could get credit for turnover of tier zeros, and then once they'd taken care of their tier zeros and their dirtiest tier ones, they could get credit for retirement of tier ones as well. And this retirement would never expire, or this credit would never expire. So you could accumulate credit today and use it 8 years from now if you wanted to. Okay. So this is just, again, describing that what we're proposing now is all turnover of tier zeros would count, all turnover of the dirtiest tier ones would count, those that didn't have a PM standard, and then once those were taken care of, turnover of other tier ones would count. The reason that we are, yes, yes. Oh yeah, I'm sorry, sir. Could you come on up so the folks can, on the webcast could hear you?
Don McIntosh, A.L. McIntosh Company. On your 174 horsepower and lower, you are carrying it at 0.6 grams in your standard, in your proposal, which makes it dirtier than the Tier 1s, which are a 0.64. So in our case, we have three machines that we would have to turn over the Tier 1 machines before the Tier 0s. And that does not seem to be correct or fair. The machines we happen to have a grams per brake horsepower of 0.254. We think the standard should be down around 0.4, not 0.6 for the 174 and under horsepower. I wrote you a letter about this before and never got an answer. Have you guys looked at that at all?
So your question is why does the PM look higher in some cases for Tier 1 vehicles rather than the
Tier
0?
You put an arbitrary standard in the rule of 0.6 grams. And I maintain that it should be 0.4 in that horsepower range. I have a list of CAD equipment here and in for 2001, and there isn't one engine that's over a 0.4. They're all under, significantly under 0.4 grams per horsepower.
Okay. The way all these sort of emission factors are assigned for all the various pieces of equipment is based on the emission standard that they were certified to. So you may be looking at test data, and it's always going to be underneath where the actual standard
is. No,
was,
you arbitrarily put, because we suggested a 0.4 3 years ago, and Tony made it a 0.6, which makes it dirtier than a Tier 0.
Okay. Well,
and it's actually cleaner. Our machines are at a 0.254, and we're carrying them on your spreadsheet at a 0.6.
Okay.
Which is penalizing us in that horsepower range.
So just in general, we picked the emission standard that's assigned to all vehicles. So if you're looking at actual test data,
There is no emission standard for a Tier 1. It's a blank.
Okay, for Tier Zeros and for the
And everything else is a 0.4. Why did you arbitrarily pick a 0.6 for that? Likely is a 0.4.
For the Tier Zeros and the Tier Ones that had no PM standard, we had to derive sort of an equivalent standard, what we call.
But why couldn't you go back to the emission standards and get something that was more accurate?
Well, if you want, I can show you the spreadsheet and the exact data that we used to derive that sort of quasi-standard for the Tier Zeros and the Tier Ones that had no PM standard.
I'd like to see it, because I think it's totally unfair in that horsepower category.
But and then the other, so then you're also saying that you would like to be able to take credit for the Tier 1s, especially if they were dirtier than the Tier 0s?
I keep my Tier 1s because they're clean, and get rid of that pair of zeros. But when I put it in your calculator, it doesn't work because you've assigned a 0.6 as an arbitrary number.
Okay. So if I could get your card, I would be happy to send you the exact calculations and where that came from.
Send them to Mike Lewis.
I think I have before. Okay. No? I'm okay. Thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is Bill Davis. I'm with the Southern California Contractors Association. Two questions. So the first one is regarding anything under 175 horsepower, you all are subject to receiving a waiver from the EPA to actually enforce those provisions. And that matter is now subject of a lawsuit in the federal district court in Washington. To Don's point, I would suggest, since you're making some changes in the rule at this point anyway, you should revisit the question of the standards for the Tier 1 engines in that horsepower category and make sure that they're closer to accurate than they are currently. Second, to the question of whether or not you are following the order of the reduction in the fleets because of the dirtiest first. The legislature was fairly clear, as I understand it, in the question of any tier engine is allowed to be retired under this program and receive credit. Is that right?
Bill raised up a letter that he has that I actually saw for the first time late last night.
It was signed by 29 members of the Assembly and 16 members of the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And what the comment that they've submitted in there is that there was the legislature's intent that we give credit for retirement of all tiers and not just tier zeros or tier ones. So that's definitely a comment that we'll be taking into consideration.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Can we have video? Yowza. Okay. Okay. So... this one. Okay. So the reason, if you're wondering, well, why on earth did ARB staff propose only allowing, you know, credit for tier zeros and tier ones? Let me just explain briefly why, and then we'll stop belaboring this. The way the regulation is set up, it's trying to push fleets to turn over their dirtiest vehicles first. So the way the NOx requirements and the regulation work is that you have to turn over your zeros and your dirtiest ones before retirement of any others would generate any credit. And so, again, for simplicity and trying to stay within the structure of the current regulation, that's what we were modeling this proposal on. And we also, since these credit provisions extend not only throughout the past back to March 2006, they extend up to March 2010 in the future, we also really wanted to avoid providing fleets with an incentive to get rid of a bunch of their clean vehicles. And for example, we were thinking of, well, what if there's a fleet that has payments on a bunch of Tier 3s and times are tough and they don't want to make those payments? We didn't want to incentivize getting rid of those Tier 3s and making their fleet dirtier. So that's why we've proposed, but we certainly are listening and welcome folks' comments and suggestions. We also propose that in order for the horsepower to count, your horsepower has to have decreased from March 2006. So you can't say, oh, well, I was at a really high horsepower in 2008, and now I'm lower. It's only the difference between March 2006 and March 2010 that would be how much the fleet actually shrunk. So that's what we're proposing to limit that to. So I wanted to pause here and make sure first you understood what we were proposing and then see if folks had any additional comments on this. I know Bill did, but no? Okay. All right, so the third one. You got one?
Okay, so I just wanted to read that we had two internet questions come in. And one was from Chuck Barnett. He was asking if when you talk about a fleet, you're talking about the entire fleet or just the reported fleet. And I believe he's talking about if you're a large parent company, but you have many subsidiaries that you report as separate fleets, is it you have to retire all the Tier Zeros first in your little reported fleet or in the whole fleet aggregate altogether?
Okay. The way, I'm sure Elizabeth knows this answer too, but the way the regulation is set up is for determining fleet size, companies have to report all, companies or agencies have to report all the vehicles under common ownership or control. But once you do that, you can then split your fleet into subfleets. For example, if there are different divisions or locations that are managed separately. So in this gentleman's case, if he's got different subfleets reported and complying separately, then each subfleet could take advantage of these new credits separately, just like they're complying with the fleet averages separately or complying with the BACT separately. I do want to make sure folks understand that you can't just be carving your fleet up arbitrarily. There has to be some reason, like a division or a different responsible person or some reason that you've cut it into subfleets.
Okay, and we have another question. Does the new Tier 1 turnover credit provision require that all Tier 0 engines be turned over first? And the answer to that would be yes, it does. Or for the shrinking fleet.
Well, that's staff's proposal.
Yeah. Staff's proposal currently.
Yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts on this one before we move on? Okay. I'm kind of lost in the presentation here. Okay, and so we did also want to talk about what records would be required and what we had to demonstrate that this shrinking of a fleet has occurred. What we had proposed on April 7th was that basically fleets give us everything, all vehicle and engine data for their fleet from the past and currently to demonstrate that these vehicles were turned over and the fleet shrunk in this manner. On April 7th, stakeholders suggested that, well, yikes, I may not really have all that really detailed information. Do you really need all that? And so we're looking at whether we may be able to accept, just a list of vehicles with the horsepower or whether we can accept something less thorough than that, but that still documents that a fleet has shrunk. And I would like to specifically ask folks if anyone has any opinions about that, what level of records should be required to demonstrate this. Any? JT, did you have a... Okay. So this is going to be James Thomas with Neighbors Drilling.
I would just like to report that I definitely, and I would imagine probably 95% of the people in this room do not want hour meters, do not want daily record keeping, because we do it in the portable equipment. We submit them on an annual basis, and everybody that's in the program don't even present it to CARB, and it's a requirement of the regulations. So we do not want record keeping that is going to be huge. I understand demonstration of the ability of showing reductions, but we definitely do not want daily records, hour meters, and I'd like to point out that most of the new engines have computers on them. If you have a computer that you can tie into the engine's computer, you can get the hours of operations annually, and it would be a heck of a lot easier to do a whole year rather than daily. So don't go to record keeping. Thank you.
Okay. Cool. That's a great comment. It's probably a little bit more pertinent to the very next thing I'm going to talk about, which is credit for reduced activity. So that could be a good segue, unless Bill has another comment to share.
Can everybody hear me?
Not on the webcast, they can't. So this is going to be Bill Davis. Okay.
You were asking basically what kind of records they need to prove that they turn their equipment over or dispose of. Bill of sale would be one. If it's a piece that's been retired and still retains the parts, then the destruction of the engine or the demolishing of the engine, whatever engine requirement that there is in the Warrior program, should suffice for your records in this arena, doesn't it?
But then for the so that would be what you're suggesting for the vehicles that were retired. What would you suggest for the remainder of the fleet that's still there? Oh, I didn't repeat the question. I'm sorry. Bill Davis from the Southern California Contractors Association suggested that we could accept either like a bill of sale or a certificate that a vehicle has been destroyed, similar to what the Carl Moyer program currently accepts. And then my question back to him was, okay, what about for the vehicles that haven't been retired? Okay, yeah, come on up so people can hear you. Okay.
Sorry, Bill, you got to make the trek up here.
Got a lavalier in the system?
No, we don't.
Maybe you should take a seat in the front.
I suspect I might. I thought the question was about early turnover, Kim. And so early turnover, you know, they're not going to be able to go up and dig up the complete doors kind of requirement for or equipment information, but they should either have a bill of sale or a record of the destruction of the engine if they're keeping the chassis, which is allowed under the rule, for parts.
And then you say, so then the vehicles you have left, then the door state is sufficient?
I would think. Okay. If, you know, I mean, if they're not in the door system, they're in trouble already as a large fleet. So,
okay, thanks. We'll take that into account. Thank you. Okay.
And do you mind if I hop right in real quick? There's a related question. I have an email here from Amelia Gooding. And she says, in regards to turnover, if you retire Tier 0 engines and replace them with up-to-date Tier engines, is it correct that it must indeed be a reduction in total horsepower to get turnover credit, specifically for PM reductions? If so, the term turnover is a little misleading.
Yeah, this new credit is only for retirement in a fleet that has reduced horsepower. So if you're just retiring Tier 0s but you've been maintaining a constant fleet size, then this new provision wouldn't help you. Okay, so with that, I think I'll go to the third one. That's okay. Okay. And this is this was foreshadowed a little bit by what JT was talking about, which is the idea here was for fleets that used to operate their equipment a lot and now maybe a lot of things are parked because there's not much work, that has reduced emissions, and so fleets should be able to take credit for that reduction in activity. And this credit, unlike the previous one we talked about for fleets that are shrinking, is only applicable in 2010 and 2011, so it would expire after 2011. And the dates that are specified in the legislative language, which again you have before you in your handout, are that you're looking from July 1st, 2007 to March 1st, 2010. What we proposed the first time when we made a proposal on April 7th was that we look at the year beginning July 1st, 2007 and the year ending March 1st, 2010. A number of stakeholders at the April 7th workshop didn't like that. They thought it would be better to have the initial period be earlier. And so now we're proposing to have a year period centered on July 1st, 2007, and then be comparing that to the year ending March 1st, 2010. And the way staff is proposing to interpret this is if you had, you know, a 10% reduction in activity, you would apply that percentage directly to your horsepower, and that's the horsepower credit you would get towards both the PM and NOx requirements. Okay. And the way this would need to be sort of calculated out is that we'd need to be looking at a reduction in horsepower hours and not just hours. And the reason that you have to bring horsepower into the mix is if you think about it, a fleet that, dropped their usage of a huge, 1,000 horsepower haul truck but by 100 hours, but increased their usage of a little tiny lawnmower by 100 hours, their emissions have definitely come down. So you need to be looking at horsepower hours and not just flat hours. And we had a lot of discussions at the April 7th workshop and then subsequently about what kind of hours, what kind of records fleets would reasonably have to be able to demonstrate that this activity reduction has occurred. I mean, ideally, you'd love to see hour meter records for every single vehicle and every single fleet, but what we heard on April 7th was basically nobody has that. And so we've been looking for, well, okay, what are additional sources of activity data that we could utilize? And pretty much every suggestion that someone had, someone else had a reason, well, why that's not exactly going to work. You know, some folks suggested, well, what if you had red dye diesel records? And then some other fleets would say, oh, well, but I use my red dye diesel in my portable equipment as well, so it doesn't necessarily correlate just to my mobile off-road usage. And then, you know, some folks said, well, I have revenue records, but, you know, revenue is not necessarily proportional to how much you're really utilizing your equipment. We did get a suggestion that we could use operator hours, and that perhaps those are even down to the level of detail of knowing that, you know, this particular operator, Mr. Smith, operated this particular scraper this many hours each year. So something like that, I think, is pretty promising for giving us the kind of information we'd need. What we proposed here after talking a lot about this internally was the idea of having a threshold where up to a certain amount of credit, we would be pretty liberal in the quality of records that we would accept. Basically, we would be able to accept incomplete records for fleets if they're asking for up to, say, you know, 15% activity reduction. But for fleets that want to claim a lot of activity reduction, then we would need to be more careful to make sure we had complete records. And the idea behind this was that we know there are going to be fleets who really have dropped off in business. They really aren't operating much now, and they used to operate a lot more, but they don't have perfect records. And we want to make sure we're able to give them some credit. And at the same time, we don't want to be giving credit where activity reduction didn't really occur. So I would really welcome any suggestions about if folks like this threshold structure, if there are other kinds of records that folks think we should be accepting or looking into. Let me go forward here. So you know, and actually, I think, did Beth White come back? Or is she off copying? One thing we did at the April 7th workshop was to take an informal poll. So how many people here have fleets of off-road diesel vehicles subject to the regulation? Okay. How many of you have some hour meter records? Okay. How many of you have hour meter records for every single vehicle going back to 2007? Oh, okay. That's pretty good. Does anyone have any other suggestions or comments on this issue?
What about your equipment that you sell, like for 2007, and then you buy more in 2008? So how would you balance the equipment? Because you have different. You're running this equipment until this year, or 2007, and then it sells in 2008, say in March.
Right. It could get pretty complicated. What we've proposed, the next part of the presentation talks about, so, okay, how do all these credit provisions work together? What we've proposed here is that you either look at for your whole fleet how your activity went down, or you look at for your whole fleet how you shrank. And so if you're a fleet that shrank and reduced activity from some vehicles, then you'd need to find, you know, the one parameter that best reflects that. As I'll talk a little bit more about, we're still, you know, trying to find the very best way to provide fair credit without double counting. So, but you're right. Like, you'd need to look at if your fleet is changing in composition over time, you'd need to look at hour meter records from your old vehicles and from the ones that you still own.
What about rentals? I mean, how can you keep track of employment records and stuff like that? If you're renting vehicles out, you don't have employment records or the usage.
The question was, what about rentals? You are a rental fleet. What, do you keep track of the hours that your customers use your vehicles? Like on checkout and on return? Or?
Yeah, in some cases. But the other thing is, if, like, keeping
those type of records, but also, I mean, say reduce activity. Say there's some units that you don't even use for a whole year. They're just, you know, say a certain amount. I mean, how do you get credit?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Can you come on up? And if folks could state their name and affiliation, that would be helpful as well.
My name is Anthony. It's the rental company. The other thing is, like I said, if you can keep records of showing, okay, this unit, I have a certain group of units that I have not rented for a period of time. You know, can we show proof of that, or how can we show proof of that showing as limited activity? Because business has went down. There's a certain amount of units that have not been rented. Can we get credit for a limited activity? I mean, reduce activity based on units that have not been.
And you're saying your fleet doesn't keep hour meter records, so
yes.
All you might, or you do also have hour meter records. Okay, but you're postulating, what about a fleet that has, you know, rental, knows which units are rented and which aren't, but doesn't have hour meter records?
Exactly. I mean, maybe not just in my case, but in other people that may not mm-hmm. have hour meters or equipment that doesn't have.
It definitely sounds like something that we want to include in the list of possible ways that people could document an activity reduction, so thank you. Come on up. Any from the webcast while we're waiting?
Actually, let me read one comment from Donna Nair with the Union of Concerned Scientists. First of all, they are concerned that the proposed changes go beyond what's required by the legislation and should be modified to ensure that emission reductions in 2014 are fully maintained. And as far as the reduced activity goes, documenting the activity of equipment is absolutely critical in determining the emission reductions that have occurred from using this equipment less than expected. And if we do accept documentation other than hour of use meter readings, there should be rigorous requirements to prove the level of decrease in activity, and every fleet should meet the same standards for documentation.
Okay, so they don't like the idea of different thresholds. Okay. Come on up.
Would you mind? My question is, if we do have good records, we're talking about fleet reduction and we're talking about fleet usage reduction. If we discount fleet reduction units from the 2007 threshold, can we do both?
Yeah, let me, it sounds like maybe we've exhausted this topic, and I'll move on to how we're proposing that the credits work together, and then we would very much like your input on what we've proposed and if there's different ways we ought to set it up. Let me. Oh, was there still another one on this? Come on up.
Hi, Kim. Mike Roboski, American Rental Association. I'm just confused about exactly what these reduced activity credits are. Do they carry the same weight as all the other credits, because, and this is what I think the environmental community is talking about, but not necessarily me, if they carry the same weight and we have reduced emissions for a few years because the equipment wasn't used, but then the equipment is put back in service and is operated at some high rate of usage in the future, then as far as the regulation is concerned, it seems like maybe there's some benefits that have been lost, and I'm just curious to know if that is the case, if somehow there's going to be some additional terms put on top of this Assembly Bill 8 that recaptures that and something we're going to have to consider in the future.
Okay. I'll talk about a little bit. Thanks, Mike. We'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation, staff does think there will be a loss in emission benefits overall from implementing these legislatively directed changes versus what we'd be doing if we didn't have the legislatively directed changes. And so we are looking at how we might try to make that up. And I think part of the reason that probably the legislature put a finite life on these activity credits was recognizing that while activity may be down now, but it may come back up in the future.
Actually, do you mind if I hop in and read
one more
question real quick?
Mm-hmm.
I have two that came in. One is a little bit older, but it's from Rick Wilson, and he states that when we sold or destroyed older units, we did not know of all the doors information that's required, and it cannot be recovered at this time. We would recommend you accept a bill of sale showing the year, make, and model of the unit along with horsepower, and that's in order to gain credit for units that have been sold or disposed from 2006 to 2008.
Any more before we go to Brandt?
Hi, Kim. Brandt Ambrose, Downs Equipment Rentals. I wanted to comment again about the baseline period. We still think it should be the 12 months ending July 1st, 2007, and not centered on July 1st, 2007.
Okay. You're not alone in that opinion.
I know.
Okay.
And actually, I have one more than email referring to reduced activity. This is from Carrie with Blue Mountain Minerals. And she says that we started keeping yearly hour meter records from our fleet starting in 2007 using the ARB year, March 1st to March 1st. We don't have monthly or any daily hour meter records. Could we use these yearly numbers we have for the reduced activity credit?
I think probably yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we've had a... kind of disconcerting to see yourself up there. Okay, so we've had a number of questions about, well, how do these credits work with the previous credits that we had before, and how do they work together with each other? So let me walk through kind of what we're proposing, and then if people have different opinions about how we should do it, don't be shy. Okay, so first of all, if fleets have existing credit that they've accumulated either through early repowers or early retrofits or because they've done traded out diesel vehicles and put in electric or alt-fuel vehicles, that all, fleets keep all that. No one loses anything. That all stays the same. And then there were existing credits in the regulation before these legislatively directed changes about if you turned over to your zeros at a rate of greater than 8% per year for the three-year period, March 06 to March 09, and we're proposing to maintain that for tier zeros that were replaced in that period. And then between March 1st, 2009 and March 1st, 2010, tier zero, that's basically a compliance year for large fleets. And so tier zeros that are turned over then will count towards a fleet's NOx-back requirements in that year. So that's what was already in place. And then what we're proposing to add is that fleets can apply one of the following to both NOx and PM backed. Credit for the reduced activity that we talked about, or credit for vehicle retirement that reduced the reduced total fleet horsepower. And to put this, that shows it in words, and to put it in pictures for people like me that like pictures, fleets would be able to... So let's look at what a fleet would have for NOx credits. A large fleet would have for NOx credits as of March 1st, 2010. So first they have credit for any repowers or any NOx retrofits that they've done. And then if they've replaced Tier 0 vehicles at a rate of greater than 8% per year over that three-year period ending March 1st, 09, they've got that in the bank. And then if they're doing anything this year between March 1st of 2009 and March 1st of 2010 in terms of turnover, then that counts. And then they'd get to add either their Tier 0, or like we're proposing Tier 0 or Tier 1 retirements that reduce fleet size, or the new activity credit. And then similarly, for PM, they'd get to maintain any retrofit credit they have from retrofits they've already done, and that's, you know, includes the double credit that they've gotten if they've done those early. And then they get to take credit for any Tier 0 or 1 retirements that reduce the fleet size, or that new reduced activity credit. Yeah. Not yet, but yes in a moment. So let me explain why that's an or and not an and. Here's the situation that we're concerned about. So the economy's gotten bad, and fleets are reducing activity and downsizing. But every time they, those two effects are occurring together. And every time they, for example, downsize, that reflects a drop in activity as well. So let's consider an example fleet where their business is down 30% from where they were in 2007. And so they sell off 30% of their equipment, and their activity thereby is down 30%. So really their emissions are down about 30%, and that's really what should be reflected as credit in the regulation. It's as if they reduced emissions to zero for that 30% of their fleet. And the reason that we put or and not and is because if you allowed them to count the 30% activity reduction and the 30% retirement, they'd end up with 60% credit. And in this case, that would be enough to carry them all the way through 2016 for turnover and 2013 for retrofits. So they would really get credit, they'd get double credit for the action that actually occurred. And it would be enough to prevent a lot of future emission reductions. We have received comment from a number of folks that that should be an and not an or, and that we definitely want to find a way to give adequate and fair credit for the reductions in fleet size and the reductions in activity that have occurred. But what we just want to prevent is that double counting problem that that I just showed an example of. So with that, I can open it up for comments. Coming up, Brent.
Hi, Kim. Brent, Downs Equipment again. This is a big one. And I've gone through all your examples, and I'm going to try to simplify it. I think that on the one hand, you say, well, you either have to have double credit or you don't. You get one or the other, otherwise you're getting double credit. Let's assume that your fleet reduced their fleet size by 30%, so they have this 30% reduction in horsepower. Let's assume that on the remaining 70% of their fleet, they had a 30% reduction in activity on that 70% of the fleet. So they would be entitled to a reduction in horsepower on the remaining 70% that represents 30% of that 70%. Now, I don't have a calculator, and not real good at doing math in my head, but that is, I think, what the legislature intended when they said and as opposed to or. So you should be entitled to the amount of horsepower that you've reduced your fleet by first, and then secondly, a calculation that determines what the decrease in utilization on your remaining fleet is. So from a calculation standpoint, you would most likely have to adjust your baseline, that July 1st, 2007 number, to an equivalent amount of horsepower that you now have in 2010 on that March 1st date. So if it was 100,000 horsepower initially in July of 2007 and in March of 2010 you had 70,000 horsepower left, then you would discount that baseline back in 2007 by the 30%. In other words, you take out your 30% of reduced horsepower, you get 100% credit for that, okay? Or 30% credit for that. Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying.
Okay. So now you're comparing two... this is complicated. I apologize. You're comparing two fleets, but they're a different size in the double credit scenario.
You're saying that for the remaining vehicles, you'd like to base the activity reduction that's claimed for those remaining vehicles on sort of an average fleet-wide...
No, you could do it on a vehicle-by-vehicle basis if you'd like.
So for your company, for Downs Equipment,
right.
Do you guys have records, either operator records or rental
by
records
machine,
or hour meter records by machine that would allow us to quantify that for the remaining vehicles?
Yes, we do. But even for fleets that may not have that, you could just take their baseline number and discount it by the 30%. In other words, reduce it by the, in your scenario, the 30% that you're giving them for the retirement. So if they had 100,000 hours in the baseline year and that represented hours on 10,000 horsepower, let's say, you'd say, okay, well, you sold off 3,000 horsepower. So we're going to discount your baseline hours by a representative number of horsepower hours on your baseline. Now we're going to compare that reduced baseline to the current use in 2010 and see if there's been a reduction in the activity on the remaining fleet. Because I understand, as one of the questions was, you could add and subtract machines from your fleet. You might end up with a net 70,000 horsepower, but that doesn't necessarily reflect the machines you had in your fleet in 2007. So a way of calculating that allows, that removes the double credit scenario that you're referring to in your examples, but does allow fleets a deduction or a credit for both fleet horsepower reduction and a reduction in the utilization of their remaining fleet, if there is one.
Okay. I think that's definitely something we can look
at. I mean,
I
know it's complicated.
Right now, under what we propose right now, if your fleet's in a situation where you turned over vehicles and then even for the vehicles you have left, the activity for them is down, the way you get credit for that full reduction is you'd look at the total activity at the beginning and the total activity at the end.
But the credits
the credit expires.
Yes, the credits aren't equal credits. One lasts 2 years, the other one lasts indefinitely. So there needs to be a way to get both and separate them out so that you get the full benefit of the legislative changes. And I don't think you're hurting yourself on emissions either, because if they've sold off 30% of their fleet, that's one emissions reduction. If they have 70% of their fleet remaining and that's being utilized half the time, that's a separate emissions reduction as well. So I think you know it's fair on both the emissions reduction side and the industry side.
That's definitely something we can take back and work on. Thanks for your comment.
Okay. Thank you.
Come on up.
Hello. Martin Schlagader. I'm with the Coalition for Clean Air. And I want to just acknowledge the challenge that's put in front of you by these legislative changes to an already complex rule. And I think the example of the previous speaker indicates how challenging, you know, given our record-keeping discussion a little earlier, is to accounting for every unit of work here. I want to validate the staff's concerns in the presentation about double counting and suggest that your proposal is best as an either-or situation and not the and, as previously suggested here by the speaker before me. And I do have to put that in the context of the fact of why we have this rule at all right now. We have this rule now because we have a deadline for meeting emissions air quality standards to protect public health. And that we don't want to start giving out credits in such a way that when the economy picks up via stimulus or otherwise, and we all have our fingers crossed that that occurs, that suddenly our fleets are being put back into use and we've given credit to what is now a dirtier fleet remaining idle, and we lose then some ground on air quality. So I'm eager to get to your future part of this conversation, as you promised, about what the emissions reductions are going to be and what the losses of that via these changes are, because we're going to have to make it up some way. And if people are getting credits, that may be a choice that we put in front of them. You have this either-or scenario, and if you choose one of these credits to offset the economic situation you've been in, when that picks up again, you're going to have to help make up the ground. And I'm looking for your next conversation to figure out how we make up, how much ground we have to make up, and how. Are we going to put, you know, the cleanest equipment kind of requirements on projects if you've taken credit, and then you start to ramp up, or you're purchasing newer vehicles, and you're going to have to find the cleanest available technology if you've taken credit for reduction, and then you're ramping up again. So I offer that for future conversation, but support your proposal that it's an either-or situation and not an and. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, Mike.
Mike Lewis on behalf of the Construction Industry Air Quality Coalition, and I just wanted to go through the discussion we had a little earlier today, each of the points, and tell you where we, on behalf of the construction industry, stand and the position that we have with regard to your proposal. On the first one, as I indicated, I don't think we believe that you need to have a split between, you can get 15% credit with certain data, and you can get a higher credit if you have hour meters. We don't think that there's enough hour meters throughout the fleet to do that, certainly not going back to the time frame that's proposed. So we would suggest that you expand that definition of items that are available to include payroll records, maintenance records, and hour meters, and let the contractors document, based on the piece of equipment, what they have available. They may have hour meters for part of their fleet and not all of their fleet, and need to use some other source of information. For most of them, it's important to keep those records, both for maintenance and for payroll documentation, and they should be more than satisfactory in terms of documenting the actual hours that the equipment used. With regard to the time frame, I think the legislation obviously says between two points. The position that we have taken is that you can't take just those 1 day. You need some time frame to calculate the period for the reduction in activity, and we would propose that you use either the 6 months or 12 months prior to each of those dates, that's the only equitable way to do it. It was clearly what was intended in the original draft of the legislation. Why it changed, I don't know, except for word count, is my guess. But using the 6 or 12 months prior to each of those periods is the proper way to account for the reduction in activity. With regard to the retirement credits and the order of retirement, I think the legislation was very clear. You get credit for retirement, period. It has nothing to do with the tier, engine tier. The way the rule is written, these contractors couldn't get credit for retirement of tier zeros until March 1st of this year anyway. So to now go back and say, oh, you have to have retired all of your tier zero equipment before you retired anything else, simply isn't fair, given what the constraints that were put on them by the original draft of the rule, or by the rule that was adopted. So retirement is retirement. They're entitled to credit for retirement. The statute doesn't make any exceptions. They should be allowed to take credit for that retirement, and the order in which they retired should be irrelevant. Most of these contractors, probably if they were smart, weren't retiring equipment until March 1st of this year, when they could get credit for it going forward. But I'm sure there were many that retired equipment for other reasons during that period, and they should be allowed to get the credit for it. With regard to item number 3, I think we indicated we don't have any, we concur with your breakdown on how the backed schedule works going forward, given the change that the legislature adopted. Exempting vehicles for retrofit early and for future turnover, I think we propose that you might want to consider extending that deadline. Clearly, at least as far as most of the industry is concerned, there isn't a viable, useful VDEX available for widespread use on equipment, and if you really want to incentivize it, you've got to give some time for the technology to catch up and for the economy to catch up, so that they have the resources to install the equipment. Otherwise, it's just not going to create an incentive, the incentive that you're hoping for the installation of a lot of retrofits. Double credit for NOx reductions, I don't think we have any disagreement with that. But we, as we suggested, you should also consider repowers, since you can achieve, based on the currently available NOx devices, you can achieve higher reductions in NOx by repowering from a 0 to a 2 or a 3 than you can get with the NOx of devices that are available, applicable to a tier 0. So you might want to consider adding repowers to that as well to incentivize the installation of newer engines. The proposal by the NRDC, I think we told you that's a no. that would basically say you have to give up half of your credit. That wasn't what the legislature wrote in the bill. There was no intention to say you could get partial credit. Their proposal would simply say whatever your reduction credit is, you can only have half of it, because you have to do retrofitting and repowering anyway. That clearly wasn't the intent of the legislature. And on the last point, which I think Brandt had some detailed discussion on, the statute clearly says that you're entitled to retirement credit and reduction in fleet activity. We think there's a way to calculate that, starting with your 2010 fleet and backing up, pulling out your retired vehicles, taking credit for those, because those are applicable in the out years, and calculating back your reduction in activity from your 2010 fleet back to the 2007 date, so that you can determine what that percentage reduction is, and that you shouldn't have to pick one or the other. I mean, there may be plenty of fleets that have a 40% reduction in activity, but only a 5% reduction in the fleet size. There may be some that have exactly the opposite. Whatever it is irrelevant. The statute says you're entitled to both credits, and you need to devise a system that gives them credit for both and not one over the other. We're not looking for double counting, but we think there's a way that you can make that calculation that doesn't double count the emission reductions. But in both cases, there are significant emission reductions, and they should get credit for it. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Anywhere?
Sure. Let me go ahead and there are a couple of comments that came in online. And the first one is, it wasn't clear when you were saying about large fleet requirements or large fleets meeting 2012 requirements. Are you saying that if a large fleet continues to meet the 8-20% schedule for 2012, that we don't have to meet the 14.436 requirements in 2013? And the answer to that is yes. If you decide to maintain the original back schedule of 8% turnover and 20% retrofit, if you do that each year, you will not have to meet the 14.4% turnover and 36% retrofit.
And that's because if you do 8% and only 4.8% is required, you'll accumulate carryover of 3.2% in each of those years that will enable you to meet that balloon payment in 2013. So there's nothing special that we have to write into the regulation to account for that, but that is what Elizabeth said is correct.
Right, and let me read one more because it's on the same lines of the revised BACT requirements. This is another comment from Donna Nair from the Union of Concerned Scientists, who writes, while the proposed changes to the BACT schedule will not affect the 2014 emissions of fleets who do not receive reduced activity or retirement credits, the limits will affect many fleets who do use these credits. The use of reduced activity credits and retirement credits will cause more fleets not to meet the fleet averages in 2012 to the 2014 timeframe because they will be hitting the maximum turnover requirements. The Union of Concerned Scientists recommends raising the turnover rate and retrofit limits or eliminating them completely in 2013 for fleets using credits to ensure that the fleet averages are being met in 2014 and the 2014 emissions in the original regulation are preserved.
I'm Larry Ashby with Specialty Minerals Incorporated. I had several comments to make, and one of them may affect something you're going to cover yet, but hopefully I can cover it all right now and not have to come back up here again. In relation to the three gentlemen that just spoke before I did, I thought the first gentleman, I thought that made perfect sense. Without getting into an argument of whether it's either or double dipping or whatever, I think everyone in here agrees we shouldn't get two credits for the same thing. But we also we would like to retire some equipment and then also have credit for the reduced activity on the remainder of the equipment, and to show you how that can be an advantage to the future is that right now we're sitting with a D9H that we use not very much. It's 1989 model, 410 horsepower, and our activity is way down. And enough that our reduced activity is what we're going to rely on. You look at the grader, if it's either or, you'd either go with reduced activity or retirement. And we would probably make the decision that we're not going to retire that piece of equipment. We're going to keep it. And, you know, this very, very old engine, very old tractor, and in the future the chance of us starting using that again as long as it's there it's pretty high. Whereas if we retire it and get credit for that, then it's gone. It's not going to pollute the air of California any time in the future. So I'm all for what the very first gentleman said, and the third, not against what the second gentleman said, other than I think he was trying to refer us to double dipping, and what the intent I think of ARB is to prevent double dipping, and I think we can accomplish that just as the third gentleman said. I also agree with when you go back to looking at the full year, calendar year of 2007, January 1st to December the 31st, we are in full agreement with that. Because most people, you know, they base their budget on an annual basis. So
you like our revised proposal of that calendar year centered
right,
on July 1st?
With
okay.
July being the center, we completely agree with that. We think that's very good. I know some people may track from March to March, as they said, with your Title V requirements, but that's not going to change too awfully much. I mean, for them, the July is not, if it starts in July, it's not going to be good for them either. And finally, my last question. I guess I haven't been giving you any questions at all. It appears we have a small, large fleet, which is around 12,000 horsepower. And we have our meters on all that equipment. And it's fairly easy to get the hours operated by a majority of the equipment. The others I have to go back and dig through by hand. Most of it's
by computer. Do you still have the records going back?
I have already looked at 2007, the year 2007, calendar year, and compared to so far this year, which I don't expect to change over the next year or two, and I'm looking at a 50% reduction in horsepower hours on 10,500 horsepower of our 12,000 horsepower fleet, and that should take care of us for the years 2010, 2011. My next question would be,
what about the other? Was it 1,500? Has the activity been constant on the rest?
Yeah, the other 15 horsepower, 1,500?
Well, you said 50% reduction on 10,500. What about your remaining vehicles?
I'm sorry?
Did you have more vehicles than 10,500?
Yes, it's just that I haven't. I could easily get into the computer and look at, okay, at 10,500 horse, and I've got to dig up the other 1,500. Okay. But I do know that the other 1,500 is going to be less also. Okay. So I know that we've got a minimum of 50% of 10,500 horse, that's 5,000 horse, and that takes care of us for 2 years for both NOx and PM. Now, if we were to do that, and we're allowed to do that, the next question becomes, now in the year 2012, what's the requirement for 12 and 13? Because initially you said we could go to, 4.8, 16. Well, we're going to already exclude 2011, the first 4.8. What do we do now in 12 and 13? That was my question on that.
Oh, okay. Well, the activity credit would expire, so you wouldn't be able to carry over any extra to 2012, so you would just be facing that revised BACT requirement in 2012, and then, you know, like the 4.8, and then it would jump up in 2013, unless you have, if you have retirement credit. So if we work it out so that you can claim some retirement and some activity, then that would live on forever, and you could claim that for your later year requirements, or if you've done some repowering or whatever that you have credit for, you could use that later as well.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
There was some confusion in some of the paperwork that's been out in that I saw credits being applied through the year 2016, and it looked like they included reduced activity, but you can only apply reduced activity to 2010, 2011. Is that correct?
Yes.
So whatever it is, let's just assume that you got 10,000 horsepower and you've got a 50% reduction. That's 5,000 horsepower, and what you're required on PM10 is 4,800. Then you don't have any carryover to the year 2000.
Right. It would just take care of those first 2 years, and then those would sort of disappear from your bank, and you'd be back to whatever other credits you might have had that you could use.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming today.
Okay. Okay. Let me do an internet question real
quick.
Sure.
Go ahead, Walter.
Okay, Bob Baldwin asks, will the changes addressed in this workshop have any effect on a small fleet?
I'm sorry? Oh, no, we've got one more.
You want me to?
Yeah, you want
I can, yeah, I can answer okay. That one. So for the reduced activity, it would not have any effect on a small fleet since the credits can only be used in 2010 and 2011. But if a small fleet could show that they've shrunk their fleet between 2006 and 2010, they could possibly use the PM credit that they would receive from that towards their compliance requirements that would begin in 2015. So that one portion could be used for a small fleet.
So they would sort of hang on to those credits all the way out until 2015 when their first compliance date is.
James Thomas again, JT with Neighbors. Just like to ask a couple of questions or point out a couple of interesting things.
We have been repowering equipment. We have been retiring Tier Zero engines over the past 12 years or so. We have over 200 units indoors at this time. We have repowered 90,000 horsepower to from industrial Tier Zeros to on-road Tier 1, 2, and 3. And we have realized a reduction in PM of 75% and NOx of 75%. And we did get a credit for NOx in the program, thanks to you, Kim. But we never received one for the PM part. And I think that this is real important as we move forward, because if you have a Tier Zero fleet and you're required to turn over a certain percent of your horsepower, then you have to put diesel particulate filters on 20% of your fleet. Well, if there is no device there for you to do it, you don't have to do anything. You're finished. And yet companies like myself, just because we have repowered, now if there is a device for a Tier 1, and we would be required to install them, while the Tier Zeros don't have to do anything. I do believe that there ought to be a credit for PM, for early repowers of some kind, for the people that have changed their engines or repowered them. And I have generated these reductions in PM for over 10 years. So California has benefited, and we have too. So I just ask that we don't overlook this. We did in the adoption, and I hope we think about it at this time. Thank you.
So, Jake, thank you. For your fleet, will the reduced activity credits or the retirement credits give you anything, any new credit?
I do have a reduction in, and I'll have to go back and look at it. We're probably 30% down of where we were. We have laid off, my company has laid off over 300 people so far.
Okay. Yes, please. Okay. So during the April 7th workshop, we presented some examples that kind of totally overwhelmed people with complexity. So what I have here today are a couple very simple examples. So consider a 10,000 horsepower fleet, and their activity is down 20% since 2007. They haven't retired anything. They haven't replaced anything. Under the current regulation as it stands now, that fleet wouldn't have any credit to start with. But under the staff's proposal for implementing the legislatively directed changes, they would get 2,000 horsepower credit towards both their PM and NOx-backed requirements. So that's a fleet that's operating less but stay the same size. And then the other real simple case is a fleet that is operating just as much as they used to, but they've retired Tier Zero vehicles and they haven't replaced them, so they've shrunk. Again, this fleet, if they had retired Tier Zeros in 2008, but that retirement didn't exceed 24% over 2006-2009, they wouldn't have had any credit under the existing regulation. But now with these new changes, they would get 2,000 horsepower credit towards both their PM and their NOx. And so even if we've had a lot of comments here today about trying to tweak how we take into account fleets that have had both reductions in activity and reductions in fleet size, even if we change that, this is still going to be the case. Fleets are going to see new credits that they didn't have before that will hopefully help them through some of these difficult economic times. Okay. So speaking of difficult economic times, what I presume was the reason that the legislature directed us to make these changes was to provide some relief to fleets affected by the current recession so they could delay some of the costs that they will incur for compliance with the regulation. And that's good economically. We are concerned, however, that there are a number of companies that had geared up to provide retrofit and repower solutions, and that now, projecting that the offered regulation was coming into effect, and that now are left without that business, and it's going to be bad for all fleets if they face compliance requirements in future years, and there aren't those retrofit choices there for them to choose from because retrofit companies have gone out of business, and so one of the things that we have in the back of our minds is looking for ways to encourage some fleets to go ahead and get retrofits on now, both to get those early emission reductions and then also just to kind of bridge that gap for the retrofit companies that suddenly maybe have no business. Another thing that we're thinking about, just because we're air quality regulators, is what do all these changes mean for the emissions impact? When we did the April 7th workshop, we presented an estimate of, well, you know, if you make some assumptions about how many fleets have had reductions in activity of, you know, of some magnitude, and you make some assumptions about what happens to the economy, what could the overall impact of these changes be? And you can sort of debate those assumptions forever. So what I wanted to present here was just sort of a look at one fleet. So if you consider a fleet similar to one that the gentleman was up here a few minutes ago, so he had a 50% reduction in activity. Let's consider someone that had a 40% reduction in activity. That's going to mean that they don't have to do any retrofitting or turnover for the first 2 years. And that's going to mean that they have older and dirtier vehicles than they would have if the legislature hadn't made us do these changes to the regulation. And then if things pick up in the future, that fleet is still going to be it's still going to be as dirty as it was out when maybe their activity picks up. So the reason that ARB staff was looking at, well, what additional changes could we make at the same time that might make up for some of these emission benefits, is because when you have a lot of fleets like that are taking fewer actions than they otherwise would to clean up, you're going to end up with dirtier air. And so rather than argue over exactly how much it might be, that's sort of the idea that pushed us to look at, well, what other changes might we make? Okay. And just a reminder, I think some of the environmentalist folks have already made this point, but the reason that we adopted this admittedly expensive rule is to try to clean up the air here to address both ozone and PM pollution, and we're under federal deadlines to do that, and we also have a public health impact in California that we're trying to address. And so we're just keeping that in mind as we make these changes. So what I have next are some ideas for how we might mitigate that loss in emission benefits. I want to emphasize that we're not proposing this at this point. It's not really staff's call as to exactly what we go forward with, and it'll all come down to what our board decides in July. But these are some ideas that we would like to solicit input on. And then certainly if folks have other ideas, pass them on to us. So one idea that we had, and this is new since the April 7th workshop, was, you know, perhaps in the same way that we give, the regulation currently gives double credit for PM retrofits that you do early, perhaps we should give double credit for retrofits that achieve NOx reductions. And we thought maybe this would spur some fleets to take action now that otherwise wouldn't. So if you had a NOx device installed on a 200 horsepower engine, you know, we could make it count such that that had been installed on a 400 horsepower engine, and that would allow a fleet to put off later turnover. And you know, we could set that up either just for NOx retrofits that were done this year, or perhaps those that occurred up through March 1st of 2011. So this is something that staff came up with since April 7th, and I wanted to just throw out a question to the audience: do people think that this would spur any additional retrofitting? Would this be an enticing idea? You don't own a fleet.
SCCA represents an extremely large number of fleet owners with a lot of horsepower, but we also have members who are part of the solution that you guys are looking for, and Charlie is Charlie Cox with Iron Man Parts, that is one of our members. You'll have to excuse my ignorance, but has there been a NOx device verified by your agency yet? for off-road? One? How many? What horsepower do we know?
Anyone want to come up and talk about that?
Charlie? Come on.
Is it 60% like we're suggesting?
I am Charlie Cox with Ironman Parts and Services. The answer to the question is yes. There has been a NOx-reducing device verified, and it reduces NOx by 40% at present, which, given the...
Yeah. So the way the regulation is structured, it's whatever NOx reduction you get counts. It just gets factored by 60% to sort of convert from a retrofit credit to turnover credit. So a 40% reduction one would count two-thirds as much as a 60% reduction one.
Which at present is two-thirds of a repower credit.
Is that on-road or off-road?
It's off-road.
How big is it?
It's about the same size as a factory muffler. Depends on the application, obviously. And horsepower range right now is 150 to 350. A lot of questions. It's clear, Lone Star, and it is right now the verification is for rubber tire. No, it's not an active system. It's passive.
Wow.
cards out in the lobby? I don't know. awful lot of questions. The current verifications for rubber tire, the manufacturer is obviously working on a verification for other applications, steel wheel and track and things like that.
So it's not verified for every machine?
No. Nothing is verified
for every
machine.
Everything.
You got a square peg in a round hole. There are different products for different applications. This one is only for specific applications. Absolutely. Cost range, I usually try to give people installed figures. I don't know where the question came from. I don't know who to look at. Think in the ballpark of between $25,000 and $30,000 installed. So that's with installation rates and parts.
How much additional fuel do you burn in it?
The impact has been from negligible to somewhere around maybe 2%, 3%. So. You want to address something?
So judging from the excitement in the audience, this is something that could encourage a few fleets to pursue this? Okay.
I'm Craig Phillips, also from Ironman. The reason that we think this would benefit a large number of our clients is that in many cases now, a lot of construction companies are required to retrofit regardless of the rule just to win a contract, and we'd like to see them get some benefit for the expense that they have to do to win that contract. And obviously, the other reason that we think that this would be a benefit for our clients is that most would like to spread the expense out and be recognized for early retrofit.
Thank you.
Bill? Like I said, SECA has got a wide range of members and people that are trying to become part of the solution. And we as an association actually support the goals of cleaning up the equipment that our members have and making California a better place for all of us to live. We also, however, ask that your agency speed up the process on verification of the diesel retrofit devices for both PM and NOx. If you're going to offer a NOx credit, get some more. I'm sorry, Charlie, but you've got to have some competition. Get some more of these into the market. We've been told for, Kim, how long have we been working on this together? 3-4 years now? We were told.
I was pregnant with my little boy.
Yes.
And he's four.
Okay, it's 4 years. We were told then, and we've been told ever since, that you've got this enormous backlog of things in the pipeline. Get them out.
Tom?
Thomas Swenson, clear. I just had somebody come up to me and say, well, wait a minute, the standard to get the credit is 60% NOx reduction, which made my stomach about fall out of my body. That's an example, right? The 40% Lone Star.
Example.
Okay, thank you.
That's all you're going to say?
What do you want me to say?
It's all this curiosity about your device, no?
Well, it's not really a sales platform, but, I mean, I'm here. I got Tony Franco, who's also with Clear. Ironman carries our product. Cummins Cal Pacific is here that carries our product. I think those questions are probably better handled individually. So if there's questions, so Scott raised his hand. We can do that again, and then Ironman folks are over here, or you can see Tony or I.
Okay. Thanks. Gordon?
Gordon Downs, Downs Equipment Rentals. I'm going to say something that we're all sitting here thinking, but I'll get up and say it. The state of California now has a huge deficit. We're in an economic slowdown. We all know it. We all feel it. The reason we're not jumping on board here is we don't have the money to jump on board and retrofit and repower and upgrade. I have a suggestion. Let the state of California pay for everything they want in this regulation, and we will all be happy. We will let you upgrade our equipment. So it's simple. Let the state of California pay for what they're demanding and mandating that we do. Thank you.
Thank you, Gordon. Okay. Well, we actually do have Din Kwok here to talk about incentive programs. So there are some incentive programs, but, I mean, the reason I'm smiling is that obviously we don't, the state's got our own budget problems, and we don't have enough money to pay for every single fleet to do everything they need to comply. Can we go back to the slides, please? Okay, so that was one idea. Another idea that we wanted to solicit some feedback on was this one. This, again, another way that potentially spur folks to do some retrofitting now, and that's if what if we gave a lifetime turnover exemption to vehicles that were retrofit by a certain date, and even let that exemption sort of stay with the vehicle as it moves through future owners. If we do this, staff would propose to limit participation for each fleet to a certain maximum amount, like some maximum horsepower, some maximum percentage, just so we don't end up with emission benefit losses in the long term. So we did want to solicit some input on whether this is something that fleets think would be attractive and could actually move some to take additional actions, and then also suggestions regarding, well, so if we do set that limit, what would be a reasonable place to set for a maximum participation? So maybe I can open it up here. Dave, did you have some thoughts on that?
Dave Porcher, Camarillo Engineering. When you jump to this one, I was at the April 7th meeting in Sacramento, and there's one piece missing. We had talked about more credit for more credit for retrofits done earlier, triple credit, double credit, and 1.5 credit with different years on there, and I don't see it on here.
You're right. That's an idea that we floated at the April 7th workshop. And in internal staff discussions, we were thinking that probably if double credit or was going to spur people to do retrofitting, they're probably already retrofitting, and we didn't think that probably triple credit or later double credit would do any good. But if folks have different opinions on that, we certainly welcome that.
Well, I'd sure like to see it back on there for discussion.
Do you think that would make a difference? Do you think it would increase?
Well, I don't think too many people in here have the money to do much. And if you can get triple credit and do one machine and get triple credit for it, you might be able to do it. I'd just like to see it talked about a bit. Thank you.
Thank you. Any thoughts on the idea of exempting vehicles from turnover if they're retrofit early? Or thoughts on something else?
My name is Bob Sokolowski. I'm with Snow Summit in the ski industry. We have snow cats, track vehicles. We are definitely in favor of the retrofit idea, extending it, triple credit, one and a half, double, exempting equipment, maybe just tier threes, because that makes sense, if we can exempt those from turnover in the future. We would like to see the manufacturers get to the track vehicles. That's our biggest issue at this point is rubber tires are great for snow removal, but all our equipment is either construction equipment during the summer or snow cats during the winter. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your comment.
Hello. Martin, again, with the Coalition for Clean Air. You asked for feedback on the exemption of turnover for early retrofit vehicles. It's not, if you have any of the emission projections modeled on something like that, it's not reflected here, and I'd be interested in knowing that. And then it does seem to be off the cuff that you would minimize your losses in those reductions, if you will, or perhaps maximize reductions, I'm not sure which, if you're only talking about the earliest retrofits. But I'd want to see some modeling before giving some better feedback on that.
Okay, thank you. And definitely just to clarify, for any of these proposals that we do decide to go forward with, we're required to do a staff report that will include further analysis of cost and benefit.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay. Good afternoon. Mike Beasley with the Boeing Company. I think this is something that we could support. The question on limits, though, we have subfleets where there may only be one piece of equipment within the subfleet or two pieces of equipment. And if you were to set a limit, say, of 20% of your fleet's horsepower, I'm not sure how to retrofit 20% of a forklift. So you'd have to make some provision that perhaps if you put a limit on it that you're talking about up to the whole piece of equipment.
Okay. The regulation itself does address rounding when you're talking about requiring something for a fraction of the vehicle, so I'm sure we could work something out so you're not doing something bizarre to parts of your vehicles.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry, slide, please. Okay, one of the other ideas that was brought up at the April 7th workshop by the Natural Resources Defense Council, they proposed requiring some minimum annual retrofitting and turnover, even for fleets that do accumulate a lot of this new credit. And they had proposed requiring basically half of what was required before. So they proposed requiring 10% annual retrofitting and 4% annual turnover. We're not soliciting comment right now on requiring minimum annual turnover, but we did want to see what folks' response was to maintaining some requirement for annual retrofitting, even for fleets that did accumulate a lot of these new credits. So, for example, if we required 5% per year retrofitting in those early years, what would fleet's response to that be? And, of course, since there's currently double retrofit credit in place, that 5% would really translate to 2.5% now. Again, it's already a pretty complicated regulation, and if we did this, it's one more bit of accounting, but it would be a way to be sure that we do get some early retrofits. So I have heard from Kayak already that they are not in favor of this idea, but would solicit others' thoughts if you'd like to share them. Mm-hmm.
Larry Ashby again, Specialty Minerals, and our company is totally against any type of minimum retrofit. As I discussed a little bit earlier, we are operating nearly all of our equipment at a 50% level, which means we've reduced our emissions by 50%, which is much more than even what is caused, and anything beyond that, any minimum yearly requirement is something that, you know, is our business even viable? It's an imposing and unneeded expense as far as emissions, or it doesn't help emissions, and it really does put our business in danger, and we are very much against that.
Okay. Thanks.
Charlie Cox from Iron Man. I did have a quick point to your question about how we recapture some of this. If you have some fleet owners who have opted to use this early credit or the new early credits that are being given for reduced activity and things like that, and you also had a proposal out to consider extending triple or double or 1.5 credit or something like that, we already heard one speaker in support of that. A thought would be, well, why not focus on the fleets who've already received all that credit, incentivize them, and recapture what you've literally lost. So extend, for example, the double credit to them for the entire two-year period, where you're losing their credit because they're claiming the early credit. So give them double credit during that time period as an incentive to do something they wouldn't otherwise have to do.
And under your idea, would you extend that double credit to everybody or just to fleets that did receive the new credit?
Well, the proposal is already to include it to everybody. I'm just saying to definitely strongly consider it, or maybe even triple it, or whatever you've got to do to somehow recapture what you've lost. Just provide incentive to the people who literally don't have to do anything.
So only to fleets that are able to.
I'm not saying only. I'm just saying
at least
okay. at a minimum to the people who don't have to do it. If that makes sense.
Okay.
It doesn't provide any harm to them. It just provides a benefit. So.
Thank you. Okay. So moving forward.
I wanted to read one comment that came in about that online from David Pitts from Caterpillar. He says that Caterpillar has made a large investment in offer DPFs that we are not selling. We're very concerned about the changes in the law that require DPFs to only be installed in one direction, flow direction. Will our current product become non-verified? And any type of incentive would be greatly appreciated, as products not selling in 2009 may not be around in 2010.
I'm not sure if I got the question.
So I'm not too sure about the question with the DPF being installed in one direction, but as far as the minimum retrofitting being a type of incentive, it could possibly help the manufacturers that have a lot of products sitting around right now.
Okay. Gordon?
Downs Equipment, just wanted to make sure that we're recognized for how we feel about a minimal retrofit requirement. Most of us are struggling for dear life to hang on, and we're not really all that concerned about whether we can pay for retrofits. We're wondering if we can pay our employees and stay in business. So if we were offered 10 times credit for retirement, we wouldn't take you up on it. First of all, for reduced hours, most people in here are going to make it through 2010 and 2011. I would think that most people in here would have credits to make it through the first 2 years. So why would they want to add a retrofit or something costly to their equipment at this point? Maybe there's a percentage in here that don't even know if they're going to be around in 2012. So that's my point. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
In response to that again, Larry Ashby again, we do still have to replace engines. We are still running, and I'm preparing a 5-year budget, we have at least one 1,000 horsepower engine each year, and a credit, a double credit, triple credit, might make the difference between whether we just rebuild the engine or we spend a little extra money knowing that we're going to get it back in a 2 or 3 year period. So credits would be beneficial to us and might cause us to do some things that would reduce emissions in the future. So we would be open for that.
So the idea is maybe we could allow double credit or some kind of more than single credit for repowering to higher tier. Is that what you're suggesting?
Right.
For swapping out an engine and putting in a cleaner one.
Yeah, I'm faced with a budget right now. We have a 1,000 horsepower engine that we're going to have to do something with. Now, of course, the cheapest thing to do is rebuild it like it is. And with the money, as this gentleman just said, with the money problems we're faced, that is very attractive to us. It may be the only way to go. But we do expect to turn around sometime in the next year or so. And looking at our budget in the year 2010, if we knew that we could get some extra credit for spending a little more money on an engine and having a cleaner engine, it's that's something that would be lucrative to us.
Okay. Thanks for your comment. Okay.
Tom Swenson, Clear. I can quickly address the filter swapping.
Oh, okay.
This is the wrong forum. It's really a verification issue. It's in the verification regulation. There's nothing here that it has an impact on directly. I mean, I get what they're saying. We have the same issue, but it's really a verification issue, not an operative question. So if we looked at, instead of credits, an incentive, or a financial incentive, and I think you're going to get to some of this in a little bit, but what I think I'm hearing is there's going to be a fair amount of reduced activity credit that will cause folks not to have to do things in the early years. Maybe we can work with the Moyer Fund to sort of bring that back around. I mean, we've got a bigger Moyer Fund than we've ever had. We've got a shrinking pool of opportunities to spend the money on. If they're not required to do something through the rule, which is a little bit weird because they're using credits, they're actually required, but they're using credits to comply. They're really not required to do anything. Maybe we can open up the Moyer language to allow payment, right? So they don't have to come up with the cash.
Din, did you want to respond to that at all?
I'm Din Kwok. I work in the Carl Moyer program. Basically, for Carl Moyer, you need to be surplus to the regulatory requirements. And based on the proposals that the staff is proposing right now, it would probably offer more increased eligibility for large fleets. It really wouldn't change Moyer funding overall. Right now, for small fleets, you have the best chance of getting funding. Medium fleets, there's still some opportunities. Large fleets, you're going to have to bring a large portion of your fleet into compliance before you can get funding. So, I mean, we're going to have to see how this the changes to the rule works out before we can figure out how we're going to change Moyer. But at this point, I don't anticipate very large changes. So,
but it could be if a fleet finds that suddenly they're already compliant with 2012 or 2013 because they have a lot of activity credit, that might open the door for additional Moyer opportunities for them?
This is Bob Cross. I'd like to look at it further before we say that unilaterally, because I guess I hadn't considered it in the context that this gentleman was saying, and I think we should look.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Juan Hernandez. I represent Orco Block. And going back to the question of minimum annual retrofitting, we would support the minimum annual retrofitting if there was funding to help offset the cost to pay for $13,000 to $30,000 retrofits or filters for that matter. I don't know if it's safe to assume that a lot of the people present are from private companies like ours. But if so, they suffer the same fate that we do, in that in one way or another, the Reinvestment Act funds or the Moyer Assume funds really don't benefit us. But it's interesting that the same private companies who are contracted and subcontracted by private companies like ourselves that, you know, help level the land that they build on or provide the raw materials that the public agencies use to build and grow with aren't necessarily eligible for the same type of funding that are out there. So, again, just to kind of get back to the point, we'd support, you know, triple credit, double credit for these additional retrofits had there be available funding that we could all qualify for. I know we're definitely looking at the SOON program, but, you know, even that is a stretch for an industry like ours where a lot of our fleet includes smaller diesel forklifts that don't qualify for the program based on, you know, Class 7 and Class 5 distinctions. So assuming there was more funding, you know, I think more of us might be, you know, interested in supporting the minimum and a retrofitting, kind of like the gentleman said earlier about, hey, you know, if there was somebody willing to pay for this. But I think a lot of us private companies are in the same boat here where we don't qualify for that funding that federally, either, well, for example, the reinvestment fact, you know, threw out there, but we can't take advantage of it, yet we help a lot of the companies that will be able to take advantage of it.
Thanks for your comment. Okay. Slides, please. Okay. Well, all this talk about incentives is a great segue to where we were going next. And that's just to note briefly that there are some new federal monies becoming available as part of the federal stimulus package, and some of them are targeted specifically at reducing emissions from diesel vehicles, the DERA or Diesel Emission Reduction Act funds. And some of that money, $300 million, has been allocated to national and state programs, and ARB has applied for some of that and is continuing to apply for some of that. So it's possible that some of that additional funding could become available. Okay. So we talked about the legislatively directed changes, and we talked about some ideas that we're considering for maybe making up some of the emission benefit losses that we could see from those changes. There's some additional sort of cleanup items or clarification items that we would like to take the chance to fix while we have the regulation open. And let me walk you through the ones that we're currently considering. One is, right now the regulation exempts nonprofit training centers, and those are primarily union training schools intended to train operators of heavy equipment, and they typically get hand-me-down vehicles and didn't have the resources to be purchasing new equipment or retrofits. So we exempted those, and since we adopted the regulation, we found out that some community colleges run similar programs that have the similar economic problems, so we're considering expanding the definition of nonprofit training centers to include those community college training programs. We also have made the interpretation that, as some of you know, the regulation includes a provision that if, say, you buy a retrofit or you buy a repower and there's a manufacturer delay so you don't get it on time to meet your compliance deadline, as long as you ordered it 4 months ahead of your deadline, it counts in the regulation as if it was in place. And we've been interpreting that as staff to mean whether that's a delay on the part of the manufacturer or the installer, as long as it was out of the control of the fleet, that would be, if it's not under the fleet's control, they shouldn't be penalized for it. So we wanted to go ahead and write that in so it's clear. We've also had the comment from from some of the airlines that the way that the regular regulation is set up, if you can't install a retrofit safely, then you're not required to do the retrofit. And they've asked us to include if there's a Federal Aviation Administration safety-related requirement that would be violated through the installation of the retrofit, that should be exempted as well, just like we take into account, you know, OSHA or MSHA regulations. And so we think that's a good idea, too. And then we are also considering, right now, if you're a private company and you use equipment solely for preventing fires, like putting in fire breaks, that's part of forest operations and is therefore exempt. But if you're a public agency and you're using your equipment to do exactly the same thing, that's not exempt. And so we're considering whether the public agency equipment should be treated just like the private company equipment. So we may make a tweak to the forest operations provision. Are there any other provisions in the regulation that folks have tripped over that you think we ought to address?
Hi, my name is Steve Castor with the City of Lompoc. As it relates to vehicles that fall under the regulation, classified as off-road, what if you have a rubber-tired off-road piece of equipment that is licensed and registered through the state of California for use on public roadways?
Okay, we have
where
a
does that vehicle fall under?
Okay, we have a guidance document that's all about this topic that I can give to you. Bottom line, it comes down to whether that vehicle was built and intended for on-road use or off-road use. So the fact whether or not it has a license plate now doesn't decide it. It's whether, so for example, for your vehicle, was it built with an on-road engine intended for on-road use?
Initially, no.
Okay. So it was built to be an off-road vehicle, but maybe what, has an SE plate now? Or?
It's got a California exempt plate.
Okay. Yeah, so that's still going to be, it has an off-road engine?
Yes.
Okay. That's still covered under the off-road regulation. And give me your card afterwards. And we have something on our website called the Knowledge Center where we have answers to frequently asked questions, and that is a frequently asked question, and I'll give you that, that it walks through kind of a flowchart exactly how you figure out whether it's on-road or off-road.
Okay, now is that going to be a double-edged sword where it's going to fall under some sort of on-road regulation as well?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. It's a race.
Hi, Clayton Miller with the Construction Industry and Quality Coalition. Another concept that I think you might consider in terms of incentivizing the regulation is that some of the larger fleets are required under the South Coast Soon program to participate in the program, and in that program the money that the district provides could cover up to say 80% of the cost to perform the repowers. And I guess the idea would be that the remaining percent, well, the other 20% that the contractor had to pay for out of their own pocket, there's no mechanism now to capture those emission reductions and credit those to the contractor or the fleet that had to pay for that. So I think that could be a mechanism to help provide what is really due to them under that program, and it might help with that program somewhat as well.
So, and this is your idea is that this would be more of an adjustment to the regulation rather than something that would spur additional actions?
Well, I think it's a disincentive, frankly, in the SOON program now that, you know, a participant needs to count the engine that they repower 7 years on the books at what it previously was at Tier 0, or I guess it could be a Tier 1 as well.
Do you think for fleets that they actually have a choice whether or not they participate in SOON, that might lure more of them into SOON
possibly.
If we change that? Okay.
Possibly. I think it's also an equity issue. Thanks.
Les Davies, A.W. Davies. I've got a large fleet of Tier Zeros, and I've been told that if I retrofit the Tier Zeros, even if the retrofits get good and clean, I still can't sell the Tier Zero in California. Can that be looked at again? I mean, if the thing's clean, there's no reason to get rid of it. Doesn't make sense.
Okay. I understand your comment. We can look at it.
Second thing I'd like you to consider is right now the truck industry is going through this same stuff with clean air and all that, and a lot of us have trucks that fit that fleet. And to retrofit the off-road equipment and retrofit the trucks is, you know, really going to be difficult. Is there any consideration for those programs?
Well, right now we're looking in the context of the off-road regulation, and hopefully some of these legislative changes will give you some relief in the next couple of years.
And when you start changing my trucks, too, in a year, I'm going to have a real problem.
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so
Actually, do you mind if I finish up a couple online questions?
Go for it.
Okay, I got a comment from Rod Michelson, who says, I think we are still going to be in trouble in 5 years when the PM average has to be down to a 0.16 gram per brake horsepower hour limit in 2014. All this early stuff is just going to postpone a huge drop needed by then and make it even harder to attain. Since we own equipment for 12 to 15 years, equipment managers have to look out 5 years at least.
Okay.
Hi, Kim. My name is Suzanne Sivright from Valley Power Systems. Thank you for coordinating this workshop and taking consideration of the off-road industry suggestions to make this regulation truly meaningful. One suggestion I had in regards to incentive opportunities is to maybe increase the statewide Carl Moyer program to fund fleets that spend under 75% of their time in one air basin. I deal with a lot of fleets helping them put together their applications for the particular air districts, and that seems to have been a reoccurring hurdle. Thank you.
Thanks for your comment, Susan. Okay. Okay, can we go back to slides? We're almost done. I appreciate everyone taking the time with us today. Okay, so here's the next steps in our process. We're going to process all the feedback and good suggestions that we've gotten today, and then we'll be coming out with a public notice and a staff report with staff's final proposal. Well, not final, with staff's proposal in early June, and then there'll be an official 45-day comment period on that, and then our board would be considering our proposal at their hearing in late July. And if you think of additional things that you want to tell us or ask us about, please feel free to contact us. And there's contact information for all of us. I'm Kim, and some of my other staff is listed here. And that's the end. And here's our website where you can go for probably more information than you want about our regulation. Thank you very much. Oh, no.